Welcome to this week's podcast, hosted by myself, Kirby Lakranji, and Dawn Riddler. This is the podcast that we base our newsletter on for Rexilom Invest. It's a weekly issuance where we look at the world, we look at South Africa, we look at markets, and we look at anything that we might find interesting, both as advisors and as asset managers and investment managers of individuals and companies' long-term wealth. Dawn, markets interesting this week. The S&P 500 was up by 1.31% for the week. Year to date now, S&P is back up again at 15%. Remember, only about 2 weeks ago, it started looking a little bit, you know, it was starting to go down into single digit numbers for year to date. It's now back up at 15%. The NASDAQ is up 2.37%. And then small caps continue to sell down for the week, minus 3.15%. The DAX up 30 basis points for the year, 0.30%, up year to date, 9.41%. And the Euro Stoxx 50, which we always talk about, that for the week is down minus 0.03%. Rand dollar at 1873 for the week. Bitcoin now at $37,000. That was, well, below $20,000 at some point this year. It's now up at $37,000. So we've certainly seen a rebound as far as crypto is concerned, which is interesting because that's a direct measure of liquidity globally. And then if we look at bond yields, US 2-year yields was up by 4.6% in the week. US 10 years up by 1.52, and then US 20 years up by 0.44%. If you head over to the newsletter, you can see more about Brent crude. You can see the histories around the currencies and how those have moved over time. And obviously, if you listen to us talk about anything here on the podcast and you want more detail, all of that is in the newsletter. In this week, we're going to be talking about AGOA, which is a trade agreement that South Africa and other countries have with the United States, demographics, Black Friday, a little bit about chocoholics, if you're interested in chocolate. I'm sure, and I'm certainly one of those people. And then a piece that I wrote right at the end of the newsletter this week is Time is Ultimately Your Friend, which I'll be talking around a little bit later. It's one of those truisms in the market that I think a lot of people talk to, but perhaps it's maybe a little bit not so well understood. Dawn, AGOA. Let's start there. Interesting to see our take on AGOA. South Africa, I think, is going through a personality crisis. We are going through a world whereby we are seeing many of the ANC's previous friends or people that at least helped them politically are requiring their support. And regardless if you might agree or disagree with where those individuals require that support, the ANC seems to support them. I suppose one of the big ones is Naledi Pandor and how she's trying to work through AGOA at this stage.
Toby, I came across this and was the annual AGOA conference was actually held here in South Africa to very little fanfare, quite frankly. I don't know whether you came across it much in the news. I certainly it was only when I was looking into some of the, let's call it what it is, extremely foolish sentiments that are coming out of the mouth of Cyril Ramaphosa and Naledi Pandor with respect to Palestine and Israel. So that's why I actually looked into it and looked into the history and looked into what the Americans could possibly sanction South Africa on. The AGOA has been around for a long time. It is worth billions to our exporters, particularly cars, but more importantly, perhaps agriculture. It's we get preferential rates. We don't pay import duties, for example, and it is worth billions to the South African economy and particularly to the private sector. One of the tenets of this AGOA that has got the US quite rightly, in my opinion, feathers all ruffled, is that one of the tenets of the AGOA is that the countries that get this preferential treatment will not go against American foreign policy.
Yep.
And this is where South Africa, not for the first time, has what I suppose in old English you say cocked a snoot at the Americans and said, we will do what we like. And more importantly, you know, Russia and Palestine and other places that looked after us 20, 30 years ago when we were in exile, you know, we're going to support them now in their time of need. And this is extremely important. Naledi Pandor and I have heard her speak on a number of occasions, extremely well-spoken and clearly highly educated person. Maybe she is trying a bit of brinkmanship with the Americans, thinking that they'll never do it. But I think they're treading on thin ice. And it is the private sector in South Africa that are going to suffer as a result?
I mean, just in a nutshell, acquisition without compensation. I'm talking about land in South Africa specifically. The Russian arms stroke Lady R saga, which really played itself out last year, or was it even this year? I can't remember. And that has just continued along the way. And then, quite frankly, us sticking our noses into really other people's battles, and really speaking, other countries' battles along the way. And that's why I continue to look at the political landscape in South Africa, and it's almost like there's a personality crisis. There's an ideological stance that they want to maintain because that has worked in the past for them, that brought them to power, that brought the status quo perhaps to where we are today. But nobody is asking the question, is that the correct thing to be doing in the next 20 years or the next 30 years? And what are we doing today in order to cement the country and making sure that we achieve our specific growth objectives in the next decade and the next 20 years? Now, I wonder how much of that thinking is happening in governmental circles, quite frankly, because the stakes are high. There's two very large blocks that are busy developing across the world. You have the old, call it Anglo-American status quo, where the dollar rules, and you have countries around the dollar that really acts as a sovereign currency, and you have countries around that that really play towards open and free trade and trying to maintain a semblance of peace across the world. And then you have people challenging it. And we are certainly, from a political perspective, firmly in the camp from an ANC perspective, in the people that want to challenge this. The problem is, what does South Africa bring to that? In my opinion, South Africa is a very small country. We have, really speaking, commodities and very little else that we can really bring to the equation. What else do we bring to the equation apart from making noise at the bottom end of Africa? Quite frankly, the thing that we really need is trade. We really need friends. The more friends we have, the more we'll be able to trade. And the more we're able to trade, the more we can uplift the country and, quite frankly, the population in this country. But without trade, if the AGOA ends tomorrow, that could only be bad for South Africa. I don't think a Russia or anywhere else in the world, they quite frankly can make up for what AGOA will lose as far as AGOA is concerned.
And I don't think they care one jot either, Kobe, about it. You know, we are 0.5% of global GDP. We are minnows. Yep. And yes, we do punch above our weight. Much of it, quite frankly, is still a halo effect from the Mandela era.
Yep.
But, you know, you and I both know the best thing that Naledi Pandor and Cyril Ramaphosa could have done is just shut up, sit on the fence, go back to sleep.
Say nothing.
Yeah. Go back to sleep, Cyril.
Say nothing.
Say nothing. Mm. Then nobody's going to get offended because you're just, Cyril's asleep, down at the bottom of South Africa. Ach, shame, you know, but he should be supporting us. The Russia, they couldn't care less and everything else.
No, sure.
But they will start to care if they keep poking the bear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Dawn, another very interesting thing that we write about this week is around demographics. And there's some beautiful images in the newsletter. So head over to the newsletter and go and have a look at the images that Dawn has put into the newsletter. One of those is number of new marriages and births per 1,000 in China. So the stat comes from 2022. So there's 4.8 new marriages per 1,000 people in China in 2022. And the birth rate runs at 6.8 new births per 1,000 people in China. That's tiny, Dawn. I think we've spoken about this quite eloquently and quite frequently about there's this demographic headwind as far as China is concerned. And I would say that this is one of the big reasons why I am not a long-term bull as far as China is concerned, because you need a demographic base in order to uplift the general GDP in the country and then to create an environment that is expanding. And if you have a company or a corporate in that environment, they will expand with this expanding GDP. It's almost like you have a tailwind or your car has a turbo in it. You're just naturally going to go faster. And you have all these headwinds as far as China is concerned at this stage. And look, a lot of these individuals are trying to look for quality of life now as well. So these individuals are being born into a China, which is not necessarily poverty stricken like it was, say, 30, 40 years ago. We're sitting with there's many individuals that are middle class. They are going to be looking for lifestyle. They're going to be looking for quality of lifestyle. That is a very different problem, I think, to have from a Chinese perspective.
I think there are a couple of interesting things. Just over the last week, Xi actually at a conference was promoting women to stay at home and have babies. I mean, talk
So a
about,
surprise there, right?
talk about a complete 180. And of course, all of this is a fallout from the
One child
policy.
policy.
Interesting, one of the fallouts from that as well is the fact that there are 37 million extra men of marital age in
And that's a
China.
problem.
And
And that's a problem.
that's a problem. You know, that's as a result of not just the one child policy, because if it was just the one child policy, you'd expect it to be even, but there were active ultrasounds, etc., to determine the sex of a child even at a very early age. And girl babies were being aborted. You know, and let's just call it what it is. I mean, it was femicide on a grand scale. And you know, these are all coming back to bite. So one of the most interesting things that when I was doing this investigation into the changing demographics was how the fertility rates have been changing. And one of the main drivers around reducing the fertility rate is higher education, is better education, is better GDP. And you can see in China that there has been a dramatic increase in the per capita income that you see from an individual's perspective. It's more than doubled in a short space of time.
Dawn, it's quality of life at the end of the day.
It is quality of life. And more than anything else, and I didn't bring it up in the newsletter, it's actually education of the women that result directly in reduced fertility rates, because ultimately they're the ones that have control. But what is interesting, and I mean, we've known this for a long time, is that Africa has still got the highest fertility rate in the world. So the fertility rates in Africa have been a problem for a long time. We've known about this. I mean, I remember even back in the sort of 90s and 80s, when fertility rates in places that I lived in, like Kenya and Rwanda, were running up at about 10 children per woman of reproductive age. And this is the one area where it is predicted by the UN that if you can start increasing the quality of life and the per capita
Income.
in Africa, that the global growth rates will start to decline far quicker than we expected. There is a projection that global total population will cap at in around about 2080, but with a 30-year leeway on either side, particularly on the downside. And that th those 30 years comes from decreasing birth rate, particularly in Africa.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, I mean, I think it's quite an interesting area of study, and it's quite an interesting and it's quite interesting how different countries obviously look at this problem and then try and deal with it. I was listening this week to a lady by the name of Kathleen Carrico. Now, I don't know if I'm saying it correct. Maybe her surname is Carrico. She's a Hungarian-American biochemist who specializes in ribonucleic acids. So it's really RNA mediated mechanisms, particularly in vitro described messenger RNA for protein replacement therapy. This is a woman that has won a Nobel Prize in her area of study. And one of the questions they asked her is, you seem to have achieved this, but you seem to have also achieved a family life. How did you do this? She says, well, you can only do this really if you have support. You know, I've been able to achieve my lifetime goals of what I wanted to achieve, but you can't do that if you don't have the support. So I have a very supportive husband. That's the one thing that's helped. But then I had a country around me that provided me with a system and a mechanism whereby I could, you know, leave my kids at kindergarten, for instance, or, you know, allow other people to look after my kids whilst I was trying to deliver a paper, for instance. So, you know, sometimes the world thinks about fertility rates as an either or, and sometimes it's not. You know, here's a good example that perhaps if the world starts thinking more about how they can support their women folk in order to actually have children and have a career alongside that, perhaps one could see a change in that over time. Dawn, it's also interesting in the actual newsletter, there's a wonderful graph that you've put together on the world in 2100. I won't be around anymore. I don't think you'll be around anymore either, Dawn. But it shows that the world population at the moment runs at about 7.8 billion. And it looks like we might peak at just over 10 billion individuals in the coming decades before world population starts decreasing. Just quite frankly, I mean, these are all projections based upon just because world overall quality of life per capita has increased. But that gives us another 28% increase in the overall size of the world population. That's interesting because that's quite a lot of people that we're going to be adding to the world still.
Yes, it is. And there's always the worry that we would have the resources. And the resources that are more likely to be constrained is our water, is probably the biggest constraint in terms of resources. In terms of food, there is so much wastage around the world, particularly in the West, when it comes to food, that we will probably be able to make do with food. But clean, potable water will become increasingly difficult, I think.
Absolutely. Dawn, one of the things that we could chat about as well is, and I've written a piece this week about time is ultimately your friend in markets. Now, it's quite a departure for me because generally what I do is I talk about markets. I talk about companies and earnings and, macroeconomic type things and so on. I thought, let me get one out of the history books and let me talk about one of those truisms in the market. And one of those is what we call time in the market. Now, time in the market basically refers to if you're going to be investing, don't try and time the market. Just try and stay invested over long periods of time. That really is what it's about. Now, Dawn, you'll know that this is one of those things where you kind of tell investors, you tell clients, you say to clients, listen, don't try and time to try and go into markets. Try and be invested over long periods of time. And it really stems from a thing I saw on Twitter this week where somebody posted the last decade returns on some companies. And I'll give those to you. Nvidia, which is a chip manufacturer or the semiconductor manufacturer, is up 13,838%. That's obviously total over 10 years. Bitcoin is up 11,000%. AMD, which is a competitor of Nvidia, is up 3,389%. Tesla up 2,200%. Microsoft up 1,054%. And before I have some people saying, but what about CPI? Here's CPI in the US up 32% over the same period. And there's other great examples of this as well. And I think that when investors see that, they go, wow, why did I not have some of those returns? Why can't I have a company like this in my portfolio where I can just be part of that journey? Because to own Nvidia, I'd also be up 13,838%.
Kobe, I was listening to an Audible book over this weekend called The
Yes.
Psychology of Money. I was actually in the chapter where it discusses exactly what you're talking about now. And obviously, psychology of money is what we call behavioral finance. And the reasons why people don't do exactly what you said. Why do people not invest for the long term? And I mean, you go back to the Warren Buffetts. Warren Buffett has made his billions by sticking to the market, by starting very, very early and letting the power of compounding and staying in the market actually do the work for him. And one of the interesting things in this book, and I would recommend anybody listen to it or read it, it's really, really good, is that investors don't really understand the difference in what is risk and what is luck? If, for example, a company goes bankrupt or somebody, has invested badly and loses all their money, somebody like you and me is more inclined to say, well, they made bad decisions. That may not be the case at all. They may have just made a risky call and didn't have the luck to go on their side. And they gave a very good example there of Bill Gates. He had the luck very early on in his career when he was still a teenager to be at one of the only high schools that had a PC available to their students.
There you go.
And really, that was luck. That wasn't good planning or anything else. He just fell in love with it, and the rest is history. One of the other guys, young teenagers, was in the same group as him, and by his own admission, was actually that was way brighter than Bill
Bill
Gates.
Gates.
And they, would probably have gone on to join Bill Gates and be part of Microsoft. Before he graduated high school, he was killed in a mountaineering accident. He got bad luck, so there's always the luck that comes into it. And then there's a risk, and it's the understanding of the risk that goes with it as well. Very interesting book. I recommend anybody read it.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Talking about risk, I think people look at the share price. Let me give it to you again. Nvidia up over decade, up by 13,838%. Everybody wants to be part of that. But when you delve into the NVIDIA numbers, you'll see that their 10-year volatility is actually up at 45%. Now, that's quite high. So just from a market perspective, I'll just put this for you just into context. Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's investment vehicle, that volatility runs at 17% per annum over the decade period. So you can see that NVIDIA is a hugely, hugely volatile organization. Now, if you look at the rolling 12-month returns for NVIDIA, you'll see there's periods that you could be up over 200% over any rolling 12-month period, and there's periods that you could be down by minus 50% also over a rolling 12-month period. And the question is, who would have stuck it out regardless if the stock was up 250% or minus 50% over the whole period in order to claim the ultimate price of a 13,838% return over the decade? I think very few people. And the reason for that is because most people wouldn't even know what NVIDIA does. Most people wouldn't even understand what fabrication is in the semiconductor industry. And most people wouldn't even understand how this is changing the world in which we're living in today and the role that it's playing. Not only this company, but many other companies. And I think that in my previous life, we were educators for financial advisors, where we built the systems to allow them to educate their clients.
Well, Kobe, that's where we met.
Absolutely. That's where we
Yes.
met. And you can still remember me and the rest of the team talking through some of these things. And it was then almost dawn. It was a hard and fast rule. It's listen, time in the market, time in the market. Just stick to it, stick to it, stick to it, and it'll be fine. And then the 2008 crisis happened, Dawn, and I started realizing that people don't necessarily just do this. It's not something that comes naturally to the human psyche to leave their money in the market and let markets compound over time. People don't do this. They kind of become involved. They want to take money out of markets. They want to try and time the markets. They want to try and understand. We even went as far as trying to only send investors their quarterly statements rather than monthly statements to try and teach them how to have a long-term focus. And that failed miserably. Why? Well, because quite frankly, when things go really badly wrong, people want to see what their money is doing. So I've had to have a very big rethink around this time in the market type concept. And really speaking, that is really the birth of Rexulam Invest. That really has been the birth of where we are as an organization today. I wanted to educate individuals why NVIDIA is important, why it's important for you to own that in your portfolio, and then to build total solutions, which include assets like NVIDIA, but many other assets in order to achieve a specific outcome. We are outcome-based. Outcome-based means we're trying to get to a specific outcome over time. And the conglomeration of the various assets and how they interplay and how they work, hopefully the education around that will allow clients and investors to look at it and say, but hang on a minute, I should be owning this. This is the important thing to own. This is important ultimately.
Toby, I think this is one of the reasons that you and I do both the podcast and the newsletter, is that we've got to a stage where you actually have to keep educating, you have to keep telling people about the markets all the time, because then perhaps you will become a little bit desensitized to what is happening, even on a monthly basis, right? So that we can sort of prepare our clients and our followers to say, listen, we anticipate there's problems coming down the line, and this is what we're doing. We get hanging on to it because we think it's going to come back stronger and better, or we're selling out of it, or we're not buying US bonds. We don't think China's a great place to be, and things like this. Because I mean, over the last week, there's been a lot of chatter in sort of financial Twitter about how China's probably bounced off the bottom. But we're not scrambling all over the floor to go and buy China because, as you know quite right, you said we've got our reasons for doing so. It's getting that FOMO out of your psyche, which is so incredibly difficult. And on the downside, and I hate to rabbit on about this psychology of money, but you know, they also say there that, you know, when you've got an investor and they've got, you know, they've got family at home and they've got children at home and this kind of thing, and they know that they should stay in the market, but the market is down 30%, And they think, God, you know, am I just sort of throwing away my children's inheritance or their college fund or whatever else?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But there's a reality of being a human that, you know, bakes into all of these things as well.
Yeah, these things are all critically important. I find often one of the big things that are busy happening, I think, with investors as well, is trying to find the correct entry point into markets. So I've got a lot of investors saying, but listen here, I've got money and I need to invest it, but do you think this is a good time? The reality is I don't really know if it's a good time or a bad time. I can tell you that, look, all of these things are happening in markets or all of those things are happening in markets, but do I know that it's going to be a systemic issue in markets that will really cause markets to completely and utterly unravel? No, I don't. I don't have a crystal ball as far as these things are concerned. A good one is the rand. Yes, I mean, obviously, there's common sense. You don't want to swap money out the country at 1940 or 1950 against the dollar. But it's very difficult. Where's the rand going? Is it going to 17 against the dollar? I don't know. But one thing I do know is that when you swap your money and it is international and you align it to really good quality growth assets, you will compound out over time because those companies have to make money above their cost of capital. You do that, suddenly the rand and the dollar exchange rate becomes an afterthought. It's not really that important any longer. And again, the caveat is, you know, nobody wants to swap money out the country at 1950. Nobody knows if it's going to go to 17 or 1750 or 1650 against dollar. Nobody has a crystal ball. And with that, as the last exit point for this newsletter, thank you for joining us. It's Kirby and Dawn. As always, next week we'll have another podcast. Head over to the newsletter. Lots of interesting graphs. Go and have a look at what we spoke about and reach out to us and have a chat. Thanks for listening.